Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Yes, it's me, Jamie Lang, from Made in Chelsea, and you have stumbled across the Made in Chelsea podcast. Now, I know I'm a pretty charming guy, all right? And people come up to me and go, hey, Jamie, how do you do it? And I tell them, be enthusiastic about meeting people. And most importantly, always be ready to smile. So make sure yours are looking the best with Sensodyne. It's designed to help care for sensitive teeth. The MIC Drop is proudly sponsored by Sensodyne, here for the hashtag sensitive moments on Made in Chelsea.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Slash Filmcast, the official podcast of SlashFilm.com. I'm David Chen and with me are...
Devinder Hardwar,
Jeff Cannata,
and Christy Pachko.
Welcome to the show everyone. You can find more episodes of this podcast at SlashFilmcast.com. Email us at SlashFilmcast@gmail.com. Today we're going to be discussing what we've been watching, and then we're going to bring you two full-on reviews. We're going to be reviewing Blindspotting, and then we're going to be reviewing Christopher Robin, a.k.a. Jeff's Salvation, for the summer movie wager.
Or not, you know, as the case may be.
So, a quick word on the summer movie wager, which is the annual wager wherein we try to guess the top 10 films according to domestic box office. And Jeff, I think you're the only one that put Christopher Robin in his top 10. And
yes.
It's fair to say we were inundated with people who supported you by tweeting ticket stubs of themselves going to see Christopher Robin at the box office, you know, going to see
it's
it in
beautiful
theaters.
Thing. Beautiful. It's a beautiful thing.
Beautiful.
It was a real grassroots effort. It
for this big work. Studio movie of a known property with A-list stars.
I appreciate everyone's outpouring of support. I will say this. It's a little bit like... I do not wish to diminish the genuine goodwill that I received on various social media platforms and the sweet nature with which people sent things. But it's a little bit to me like talking to a family member and they're like, why didn't you just audition for Better Call Saul? You would be great on that show. Why don't you just audition for that?
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
In the sense that they're fighting some kind of losing battle?
They have no idea how things actually work.
I see. Well,
I think people were being a little tongue-in-cheek as well, as am I now. But your $12 isn't going to move the needle. I appreciate it. It's very sweet. But I feel like I'm going down in poo-covered flames.
So Christopher Robin took in $25 million at the box office this weekend. It will not make the top 10, meaning Jeff's list is doomed. And in fact, all eyes right now are on the Meg because Christy Pachko is currently slated to win the summer movie wager unless a movie unseats Mamma Mia 2 as the number 10 movie of 2018 summer. And right now, no movie can do that except for possibly The Meg.
I believe in The Meg.
It's extremely unlikely that's going to happen.
It's a thing that it's a cruel game because I love to root for a shark movie, and here we are where I'm rooting against it in a purely selfish endeavor because I have a movie I want to make you all watch. So
here's my thing though.
The Meg is, I've seen it. I have thoughts on it. You guys are going to talk about it next week while I'm on vacation. So you can have thoughts then. But I will say this, you could totally wait a couple of weeks to go see The Meg. It's totally fine. And also, if you have MoviePass, you should wait a couple of weeks because otherwise you won't be able to.
Well, you shouldn't wait a couple of weeks, I think.
No, because MoviePass isn't selling The Meg tickets.
Oh, that's right.
The first 2 weeks.
That's right. You know, good point.
Here's the thing, Christy. I am not exaggerating when I say the entire world is rooting for you.
Yes. You don't know how serious this is.
Yeah. Yes. Everyone who draws breath is rooting for you.
I don't know.
The hashtag anyone but Chen doesn't feel like it's especially about me.
It is now.
There is a counter movement in the Slack Filmcast to try and get the Meg into the top 10. Hashtag save Dave. Is what's happening there.
I don't think that's actually happening. I think that's you under several pseudonyms.
I cannot confirm or deny that. Anyway,
Jave Den is not subtle.
Bottom line, go see The Meg, I think is really what the moral of this story is. But yeah, feeling pretty unlikely that Meg's going to break top 10. And we'll see if it does. Speaking of terrible mistakes I've made, sometimes during the course of recording the podcast, mistakes can be made, and words can leave my mouth. And as they're leaving my mouth, I'm like, oh, I wish I could just go and reach out and grab them back. You know, I wish I could just grab it, take it back. But you can't, because once you've spoken it, it's out there forever. And I messed up royally on the last week's episode of the podcast when I... not implied. I straight up said that certain sequences in Mission Impossible Fallout were filmed using IMAX cameras. Of course, anyone with even an ounce of understanding of IMAX cameras knows that that is a ridiculous statement.
Yeah, because they jumped out of a plane with an IMAX camera, Dave. That's what you were saying.
Because IMAX cameras are extremely heavy and large, and that is not what they use to film some key sequences in Mission Impossible Fallout. Not only did I say the wrong thing, I corrected Devendra wrongfully. And so, of course,
I'm used to that.
There is nothing left for me to do but eat shit on today's episode of the podcast. And so
I do have to say the thing I was going to say during the show before I was so quickly shot down, because then I went off to try to find something to correct it, and then we just kind of went along with the review. Yeah. But it was really cool. It is really cool because they used 8K cameras, and they just blew up the image for those shots for for the skydiving and some of the helicopter stuff. That's a really interesting technique, and I wonder if we'll see more of that in IMAX like going forward, especially as digital cameras get better. Yeah,
so they invented these new kind of rigs to have these Panavision 8K cameras, and they're extremely light and, you know, they're portable, relatively speaking, to the quality of image that they could get. It is interesting to think about, like, whether we're going to see more of that, because they are able to expand that image to fill the entire IMAX, aspect ratio. So, anyway, sorry, Devendra. I formally apologize publicly on the podcast. Totally my bad. They did film those sequences in digital, and it does look different than the rest of the movie, which was filmed on film. All that said, let's move on to one other thing that I want to announce before we get to what we've been watching this week, and that is Avengers Infinity War. We were able to get Blu-ray discs of Avengers Infinity War this week, and the Blu-ray releases on August 14th. And I gotta say that I've had a chance to look at this disc, and I actually listened to the entire 2.5 hour long commentary, which I rarely do. When was the last commentary you guys listened to? Can you guys even remember the last commentary you guys listened to?
No, it's been a while.
Yeah.
Who has that kind of time?
It's a good question. I mean, to be fair, I was doing other things. You know, like I was like, I put it on the background when I was like cooking or doing other things. You know what I mean?
I think we mentioned on a previous episode long ago this idea that they should release those as podcasts.
Yeah.
If I could just listen to an audio, although there are a lot of, admittedly, there are a lot of commentaries where they just forget to talk and we're just listening to the movie audio for a while. So that would be annoying. But
I think the Movies Anywhere app, if some of them have the special features for those things. So I think you could just like hit play on the commentary in there.
I'd be into that.
For some movies.
That'd be neat. I haven't tried that.
Yeah. Anyway, listen to the commentary, which features the Russo brothers, and I found it to be very illuminating. I don't know why. I don't know why I was drawn to this particular commentary, because it is a big investment of time to listen to a commentary. But I guess even though we were fairly critical of Avengers Infinity War during our review, I still am really impressed with what they were able to achieve with that film. And the more I think back on it, the more I feel like that was such a bold decision. And we are living in a time right now. We're living in the time between the Infinity Wars, right? Or between, you know, Avengers Infinity War and Avengers 4. And it's a really special time because we have no idea how it's going to be.
Infinity Purgatory,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, and it just it's like a weird feeling because there's so much uncertainty out there. But it's also like a unique feeling because at no other time in the history of mankind will people not know how Avengers 4 is going to end.
That's right.
And
we've waited thousands of years for this moment.
Yeah. There's just nothing else like this. 19 movies of buildup
and
the 20th movie payoff. That's an extraordinary thing.
And to be extremely vague about Avengers Infinity War without spoiling it, it kind of ends on a quasi cliffhanger. One could easily argue that it's a cliffhanger that it ends on.
I mean, I think it's I see what you're doing.
Yeah. So anyway,
I really
enjoyed the commentary. Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard good things about the commentary. I have not delved into the commentary, although you talking about it makes me want to now. But I also received the 4K Blu-ray disc, and I excitedly jumped into the special features. And I got to say, they're a little disappointing. They're a little disappointing, the special features. I think in general, I want to say something even more broadly than just this particular set of special features. It bugs me, and it seems to be a pretty common occurrence now, where the special features seem to be promotional material for the movie. They're like behind the scenes, but they're basically kind of snippets of interviews and a featurette that is – it seems to be doing the job of selling me on the movie.
Yeah.
And yet I already own this movie. I'm watching the Blu-ray because I own it. And it seems like maybe these were put together for some other purpose. And then since they had spent the money to put them together, they then threw them on the Blu-ray. But I prefer real detailed behind the scenes footage. The Avengers Infinity War stuff is peppered with tastes of behind the scenes footage to the extent that you realize there is a lot of behind the scenes footage they could be showing you. But it is much more like scenes from the actual completed movie and then interviews of like, this is going to be the greatest thing. We put so much effort into it and we worked really hard. And so many people's efforts came together to make this sequence. It's like, well, okay, tell me how, show me exactly what. I go to those featurettes hoping to see a glimpse behind the scenes, to see what went into creating these incredible sequences. And I found from that perspective, the stuff on these discs was really disappointing to me.
Yeah, I think there is this, we were talking about, if you compare the featurettes for Star Wars The Phantom Menace and Star Wars The Force Awakens, right? One is an extremely raw look, warts and all, at the making
of
a film. And the other one is super polished, everyone towing the company line, like this, making this movie was the best experience ever with no problems,
Right.
And that's just the way a lot of special features have evolved. And,
it's so frustrating to me because I know what goes into shooting the components for those featurettes, as I'm sure we all do. And you'll see like the costume designer and they'll show a maybe 5 second snippet of a line. And they sat down with them for several hours and interviewed them. And there's probably tons of interesting information. They don't just pull someone aside and get 15 seconds of quote. You sit down and you talk to them and you record all of it. And then they get like, this is the biggest project I've ever worked on. And that's like all you get from the entire featurette from several key members of the production staff. And it's like, no, I want to know what went into the guy building the set. And I want to know what the stunt coordinator, inspiration he took and why he thought this character should move in this way. And I want to know how they did all this stuff. I mean, there's little bits of that. And there's the situation of the Wakanda fight. Like they cut an actual river into this place in Wyoming, I guess. Like they made a river where there wasn't one so they could shoot on a river. That's fascinating, but we don't see how? They just say that. They just go, oh, we made a river here. And it's like, I want to know all of that. And it's very frustrating that these have become what feels like really packaged promotional materials rather than sort of, you know, revealing the secrets of filmmaking.
Well, do you think that might be because – do you think they're spending less on promotional – like on these kind of materials because DVD and Blu-ray is taking a backseat to people like buying stuff digitally?
That's
I'm asking genuinely because I haven't actually paid attention much to special features since I don't buy physical products.
Yeah, I think it's less about that and it's more just like there is no upside to showing a troubled production. Like
even troubled. Like what Jeff's asking for is behind the scenes details. Like recently at the Alamo Drafthouse, they did a 25th anniversary screening of Hocus Pocus. And to prepare for that, because I was doing the Q&A with Kathy and Jimmy, I watched a bunch of special feature stuff back from 1993. And there was a ton of it that like had come on special feature things throughout the years that now were online because online. And it was actually really interesting. I ended up going to that Q&A with like a better understanding of like how they made Witches Fly than she had. And I'm not trying to be like, you know, glib about that. She was basically like, I mean, yeah, I got on a rig and whatever. And I was like, did you know your puppets had human hair? And she was like, did not know that. But like that kind of stuff to me was really cool growing up because it's part of what allowed me access to understanding filmmaking and the inflamed my passion for it. So it's interesting to me that what Jeff's saying is it seems to be that this kind of content is falling off. And I'm asking why you guys think that might be.
Yeah, I think you make a great point. I mean, the first job I ever fantasized about having was being a special effects artist. And that's because as a kid on VHS, my dad recorded from Showtime, I think, the Dark Crystal making of. And the Return of the Jedi making of. And both of those I would watch over and over and over again. And they showed Phil Tippett with the puppets and they showed, you know, it was fascinating stuff. And you get to see like, oh, this is how the magic is made. And I watched the Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol was the one with the Dubai building stuff.
Yeah.
And that is a fascinating look at what it took to shoot that sequence. You can really get a sense of all of the work they put into it and how difficult it was and how many windows they had to remove from the building and putting the cameras outside and what training crews did and all that stuff. Like I eat that stuff up. Like Christy's talking about it is inspiring. It shows you why these movies cost what they cost. And, I think perhaps it's because there's less value to these things and, we're in a digital age and people don't watch that stuff, but I wish that wasn't the case. I wish there was an outlet for all this stuff. And I feel like if you put those things on a service, you know, if Disney ends up having a digital service, why not put cool behind the scenes features big
digital releases do get like all the same special features too. I haven't seen what's there for Infinity War yet, but you know, it's there. I have noticed this trend of worse and worse special features. I just bought You Were Never Really Here. And that thing has two quote unquote special features. One is a 1 minute clip of like a red carpet commentary of the director. And then the other is just like stills, photo stills. That's it.
Wow. That's ridiculous. Like, that's like early 90s style DVD content.
Yeah. And I would have loved to hear so much about how that movie was edited and kind of how they adapted it. A lot of embarrassing stuff out there.
Well, Jeff, I'm sorry you had a disappointing experience with the Avengers Infinity War Blu-ray. I will say I think the commentary is great, and I actually think the deleted scenes on the Blu-ray are actually really interesting as well.
And the gag reel is lots of fun, too.
Yeah. So there's some good stuff on there. And after that entire wind-up of how disappointing special features can be.
I mean, the movie's great. I love the movie. As of all of us, I certainly am the one who loved the movie. And so, yes.
Listeners, this Blu-ray can be yours. We are giving away several copies of Avengers Infinity War, which again comes out on Blu-ray on August 14th. To enter to win a chance to win a copy of this Blu-ray, all you got to do is email /filmcast@gmail.com with subject line Infinity War by Friday, August 10th, 11:59 p.m. Pacific Time. U.S. and Canada only, no P.O. boxes. And in that email, you know, Avengers Infinity War has been called the greatest crossover event of all time. And I want you to tell me what your greatest crossover event of all time is in that email. Doesn't have to be movies. Doesn't have to be You know, TV can be like any medium of any kind, can be, you know, books.
Reese's Peanut Butter Cup.
Yeah.
Greatest crossover event of all time, Reese's Peanut Butter Cup.
What is that a combination of, Jeff?
There's chocolate really? And peanut butter. There's peanut
David
butter.
David Chen. Come on.
Gotcha. Okay. No. I didn't. I guess, Jeff, the concept of chocolate and peanut butter feels so intuitive that I wouldn't even think of that. Like, it's so
Why is that, Dave? Is that?
It's because they executed it so well, I think.
It's because the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup. You're welcome. Yes.
Yeah. No, that's right. Okay. So what is your greatest crossover event of all time? Again, email /filmcast@gmail.com with subject Infinity War. By Friday, August 10th, 11:59 p.m. Pacific time. U.S. and Canada only, no P.O. boxes. Okay. And we'll give some away by next week's episode of the podcast. Let's get to what we've been watching. Christy Puchko, you've been watching some stuff.
I have been watching some stuff. So, not to get back into the summer movie wager, but I went to see Teen Titans Go to the Movies. And guys, it's really great. I'm a little mad at all the DC people that didn't turn out for Teen Titans Go to the Movies, but fine. You guys don't want to support my picks? Fine. No, but like legit, Teen Titans Go to the Movies, the concept is spun off from the show. The Teen Titans, Robin, Starfire, Raven, Beast Boy, Cyborg, and who am I forgetting? No, I think that's all of them. They are upset because they live in a world where every superhero has a movie and they don't, and they want one. And so it's their quest to get a supervillain, like a nemesis, so they can have a superhero movie. And it's actually really funny. And I really like the show Teen Titans Go. But I was curious how they were going to be able to blow like these 11-minute shorts that are often very silly into something bigger and more satisfying. And I think they did a great job because basically
Is there a part where Robin says, fuck Batman?
No, there's not. And people have been making that joke and like, look, no, the Titans can do its own thing and be gritty and DCEU dark and whatever. This is so, so lighthearted and silly, but then also there are super dark moments and I won't spoil them here, but if you go to Pajiba, I wrote about the darkest joke in this movie that still, it still delights me so much. It's so, so dark. It's great, but I won't get into it here. They released a clip online, but I know some people don't like to watch trailers and stuff, so I won't share it. But Teen Titans Go to the Movies is actually very fun because it is within the concept of Robin wanting to be in a superhero movie. They get to have a lot of commentary on superhero movies that feels really natural. So there's like jokes about DCEU stuff. Like you saw in the one trailer, they mentioned the Green Lantern movie and they're like, but we don't talk about that. And like, then there's like deep cut stuff, like Nick Cage is in it playing Superman. Huh? And his son Kal-El does voice work. And there's just some really fun jokes about how the show works and everything. And then
Nicolas Cage's actual son is named Kal-El?
Oh, yeah. Did you not know that?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, you know, he's like deep in Superman.
Isn't it weird that Nicolas Cage would do something strange?
Yeah, that is bizarre.
This movie is super fun. I think if you like the show, you'll love the movie. I think if you're not familiar with the show, you should probably check out the show first. Not because you'll be lost, but you'll have a kind of sense of the style of humor. But what's a running joke in it is that that the Teen Titans aren't like serious enough to be heroes. And so it has a lot of fun with that premise, and it's just very silly. And like, if you know DC Comics, there's a lot more stuff you can get out of it because there's references and all these kind of things that zip by. But it was really fun. My husband tends not to go to screenings with me very often because he's gone to some really bad ones. And so usually he's like, what are you seeing this week? And I tell him and I'm like, do you want to be a plus one? And like 90% of the time he's like, nah, pass. So, you know, it's like after a long day of work, he doesn't necessarily want to go with me to see whatever weird, depressing thing I might be seeing. But like Teen Titans Go, he was like, do you have a plus one for that? So like we went together. We had such a good time. We were like giggling the whole way home. I really recommend Teen Titans Go. And I know some people hate Teen Titans Go because they blame it for the cancellation of the Teen Titans 2003 show. You should be excited for this movie. I won't say why, but if you go to scifiwire.com, I wrote about that specifically for fangirls and get into the spoilers there. But I think Teen Titans fans will also be very pleased with this movie's existence.
I got to ask you, Christy, what is the worst film that you've gone to see with your husband? Like, what's the movie that you're like, well, you know, at least it's not one of those again.
Well, for, okay, not, like, I don't know what I would say is the worst one, but I remember he was, like, really bummed about Elysium. Like,
oh, yeah.
That is bad.
We were all bummed.
Yeah.
I remember he came out and he was, like, pointing out all the plot holes. And, like, I swear to God, like, all the other critic friends of ours were basically, like, taking notes because, like, he just, he also works in the industry. I don't want to talk about him too much because I try to give him his privacy, but he is not a public figure. But he's really sharp with story and stuff. So Elysium drove him really crazy and he was pretty bummed out.
I appreciate how long ago he was burned and how that
psychic scars.
But no, he goes to some stuff with me. I remember he wanted to go to the Meg, but like he couldn't get out of work in time, so he was pretty bummed he couldn't go see the Meg. But yeah, he's good for like I don't know. I don't want to try to speculate on the kind of movies he wants to go see, but sometimes it's just an issue of scheduling and sometimes it's just an issue of him being like, that sounds not like how I want to spend my Monday. And I'm like, that's fair. Like, I don't really get that luxury of being like, I don't feel like I'm in the mood to see this really upsetting political drama. I just, that's my job. That's what I do tonight.
Well, that's Teen Titans Go to the Movies. And I've actually heard it's a fun time, despite the fact that it didn't make it into the top 10. It's my last week to point that out, Christy, because you're... Mm-hmm. Your victory is imminent at this point. So
we'll see. I don't want to call it too soon, but you know, knock on wood. Yeah, we'll see. But I mean, like Teen Titans Go to the Movies, regardless of summer movie wager, I think it is super fun. And I feel like if you have young kids, like they had like children in the audience with us and they were having such a good time because it moves really fast and there's a lot going on, so they're not gonna get bored.
Jeff, what were you gonna say?
I was going to say the fact that she even put Teen Titans on her list and can still win is a testament to how bad the rest of us are.
Oh yeah, we're all awful. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Terrible. Not even close to getting it right. So, okay, Christy, what else have you watching?
This weekend, I caught up with A Very English Scandal, which is a miniseries on Amazon Prime. And it was something I kind of heard about in passing a few weeks ago. And I was like, oh, I like Hugh Grant. I like Ben Whishaw. Let's do this. And I did not know anything about there was once a British Liberal Party leader named Jeremy Thorpe. And he had a huge scandal that involved his gay lover. And this was a big deal because in the time of their affair, being gay was illegal in England. And it's a historical docu-comedy. It's quite fun. It's quite English. The sense of humor is kind of cheeky and fun. But it's also dealing with these issues of about being closeted and about when your society shuns gay people, how it affects society, and not just these men who are being shunned, but also like the ripple effects it has throughout, you know, their lives and the lives of the people who love them. And it's really great. I mean, like, I've turned it on kind of out of an idle curiosity, and it's directed by Stephen Frears, written by John Preston and Russell T. Davies. So there's like a lot of names that like should get you excited about the concept. And I don't know, I fell for it really fast and I enjoyed it so much that once I watched it, I kind of just wanted to put it on again because like the energy is so interesting and the story it had to tell was so fascinating. And the way it works its politics in feels natural, but also subtle. Like it's not forcing its message down your throat. It's really kind of allowing you to fall into this world and meet these people. And there's also just a lot of great English actors watching it that I was getting excited watching because it's like I watch a lot of British TV, as we've talked about before, and I was like watching being like, who's that girl? And I was like, oh, she's from Torchwood. And it was just really fun to kind of have those discoveries as I watched it. But yeah, it's on Amazon Prime. I won't get into the history aspects too much because I feel like most of your listeners are American, and so you probably don't know anything about this because I sure as heck did not. And learning about it was really fascinating and fun and interesting. And I just thought it was great. And it's both a role that Hugh Grant is like totally perfect for and also one I didn't expect him to play because it's a slightly different version of Cad than he tends to play. And he's great in it. And Ben Whishaw's charming and interesting. And it's just such a, I don't know, it was a real surprise. Like it was something I kind of threw on a whim and was just completely enraptured by.
Very cool. That's A Very English Scandal, and it's on Amazon Prime. Okay, I want to mention something real quick. Have you all heard of The Staircase? The Netflix, now Netflix original series. It used to be, I think, on Hulu, I want to say. But it is now on Netflix and has three additional episodes.
Is it just that same thing, or did they like re-release
There's
it?
Three new episodes.
Yeah, they re-released the original 10 episodes of The Staircase. Okay. And then they commissioned three additional ones. Mm-hmm. So the Staircase, for those who don't know, is a 2004 French television miniseries by Jean-Xavier de Lestrade. And I'm going to talk about the premise of The Staircase, like, and everything you find out in the first like 30 minutes. So if you don't want to hear that, then skip ahead. But it documents the trial of Michael Peterson, who is convicted of murdering his wife, Kathleen Peterson. And essentially, like, they're hanging out. Michael Peterson and Kathleen Peterson are hanging out one night. And then Kathleen Peterson ends up dead at the bottom of the stairs. There's blood everywhere. And, it looks terrible. It looks mm-hmm. clearly like some crime occurred here.
And they do show crime scene photos. A heads up to people who are sensitive to that.
Yeah, they show a lot of crime scene photos. They show, like, you know, everything that happened. Like, it looks bad. It looks really damning. It does not look like an accident. But Michael Peterson maintains it was an accident. There is no physical proof that he did anything wrong. And that's kind of what the whole documentary – the documentary is about all the stuff that unfolds after that. There is a court case and other developments that I won't give away. And actually, Jeff Cannata, when we first talked about making a murderer, a few people emailed in and they said, hey, like, making a murderer is fine, but you should really watch The Staircase, you know?
I remember, yeah.
And it feels weird.
And we got right on that.
Yeah, we totally did. It feels really weird to compare true crime documentaries, you know, because at the end of the day, they are not simply entertainment. They are documenting actual people's lives and the tragedies that unfold within them. I will say that The Staircase is a really amazing piece of documentary filmmaking. The access that they got is pretty incredible. I don't think any other documentary I've seen goes as in-depth into the building of a defense and then showing you how the defense plays out in court than The Staircase does. But it is clearly told from the perspective of Michael Peterson, and it's clearly in the tank for Michael Peterson. It's very, very much rooting for Michael Peterson. There seems to be very little doubt in the filmmaker's mind that Michael Peterson is innocent. And to further support that position, one of the filmmakers, the editor, I believe, actually had a relationship, had an affair with Michael Peterson during the making of the documentary. So, and by the way, that affair is not disclosed during the entire documentary. So you just kind of need to just take it on an article of faith that they're being impartial. This is a thing where I thought, hey, you know, let's just put this on, see what this is all about. And I did that on Thursday. And by Sunday, I had finished the entire 13 hours.
Oh, wow. I've never gotten through that one. And like, I'm a true crime buff, but that doc just, I don't know. I can't with that one.
I mean, it is nonstop tragedy, really. Like
it's not just that though. It's like you said, it's just so icky because they're constantly around the Peterson family, but it's like it doesn't. I don't necessarily have a problem with the documentary feeling impartial because I feel like, frankly, when you're dealing with a lot of these things, they aren't impartial. You could, like, a lot of the stuff you have to make a judgment call because the facts aren't going to tell you everything. But I take issue when a documentary chooses not to acknowledge that. And I feel like the documentary is giving you hints that it's in the tank for Michael, as you put it. But as you said, like, it doesn't want to own up to it. And like, it just, it made me sick watching that documentary because I don't know if he did it or not, but the movie makes me, that miniseries makes me so uneasy because it's giving him the benefit of the doubt so much. And like, even when they bring up the stuff that happened in Germany, like I was losing my mind and it felt like I was on my own because the documentary is like, I mean, a lot of people die on staircases. And I was like, do they? Do a lot of people? Like, what are we talking about?
The leading killer of people in the U.S. is staircases.
I mean, that's effectively, I'm honestly just shocked. The only thing they didn't seem to go into, and I didn't watch all of it, but it's like they never went into the owl theory, which is like the most notorious aspect of this case.
I've heard of that. And I haven't even seen this thing. Exactly. I do have to say, though, that relationship sounds like some next level true crime documentary stuff. Like, I'm in the middle of having intercourse with this man right now. Let's see what he has to say about
season
it.
Three of Serial.
I yeah. do want
to. I don't mean to imply Sarah Koenig would never. That was a dumb joke. I'm sorry.
But no, anyone. Yes.
I do want to see a documentary about the woman that does a documentary about the dude that killed his wife and is like, I'm kind of into him. I need to know more about her.
That's a thing. That's
I know it's like, a thing. And I need to see a documentary about that thing.
And then
it's
a documentary
weird.
About the people watching the documentary about the women who made about, you know, yeah. it's documentaries all the way down.
Just documentaries.
Yeah, so I think it's totally logical. And just so you know, Christy, my wife, who actually used to live in near the area where this crime took place and heard about this case every day for months on end, she had the exact same position as you. She's like, I can't watch this. I can't deal with this because she already lived through it. So she doesn't mm-hmm. need to go revisit it.
I don't mean to imply it's a moral position. It made me very uncomfortable. And like, I was just like, I can't deal with this.
Well, I think great true crime document, despite all of this documentary's failings, and there are some in terms of the information it chooses to leave out and chooses to leave in. What great true crime documentaries do, in my opinion, is leave you, the viewer, the space to decide whether you believe the person did it or not. And I actually feel this documentary does that. I get to the end, and I still don't know whether or not he did it. You know, and this documentary allows you to draw your own conclusions, and I like that. I think that's true of a lot of great true crime documentaries, like Making a Murder did the same thing, you know. So all that said, I think it's worth checking out, but with the caveats that the filmmakers are certainly entangled with the subject and the entire thing might gross you out. So that's The Staircase. It's on Netflix, and I do think, by the way, that the additional three episodes do not feel opportunistic to me. Like, they don't feel – what I mean by that is, like, it doesn't feel like they had no story and they just dragged it out an additional three episodes. Like, there was more story to tell, and the three episodes tell that story. So do want to give a shout-out to those. So that's The Staircase. It's on Netflix right now. That's what I've been watching this week. Devendra Hardwar, what have you been watching this week?
A couple of things. So I hurt my back, and that stinks because when you do that, the only way to really fix it is just to, like, lie down.
Yeah,
and Devendra,
my heart went out for you when
days.
I saw those tweets. Like, I have thrown out my back as well.
Yeah. Not
and
great.
It is the most depressing experience because not only are you – like, you have no energy to do things, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's not even like you can lie in bed and feel great about life. It's like you just don't even feel like – you know, it's yeah. just debilitating. So I my heart goes out to you. I hope you heal up soon, dude.
It's not great. Part. It's – yeah, yeah.
I would say the worst part was that he threw it out when he saw the odds of Dave Chen winning the summer movie later.
It just knocked
so
me
So it was
up,
literally injury to insult?
Yeah, exactly.
Nice. Nice, Christy.
The good thing about laying down all weekend, though, like I literally just didn't leave the house since Friday, is I was able to catch up on a bunch of TV shows. And one we haven't really mentioned yet is Succession on HBO, and I was fully caught up and, you know, just in time to see the finale last night. And I just have to say, you guys, all of you and our listeners should be watching Succession. This is a show, like in broad strokes, it's a show about a media empire family headed up by Brian Cox, who is just like, you know, a titan in media. But he's getting on in the years, and his children are trying to figure out their ways to kind of get themselves into the business and, you know, try to succeed him. This show starts off seeming like it's just another, I don't know what you call it, like, you know, rich people porn type story, like wealth porn or something. And it quickly transforms into something very different. And I think it's really interesting, like, what it does. I gave Billions a shot, you know, a couple years ago, and I hear that show got better over time. But I was never really into, like, how it was. That show was really into the glam of that life and, you know, bad people being bad people, but also, like, really reveling in it in a way. Whereas this show, this entire family is filled with sociopaths. And what's really interesting is seeing how they all kind of, like, you know, try to survive while not having all the, you know, functions that a normal human being would have. And also being in this weird bubble where, you know, they just don't know what the rest of the world is like because they are very, very rich and anything they can do They can pretty much do anything, as you'll see in this season. At one point, one character says being rich is like a superpower. And I thought, man, that's actually a very good point, at least in the way America works right now. So I think overall, this show is a great exploration of the post-capital era, the post-capitalistic era we're in right now. And the cast is amazing. Brian Cox, just like being his full on, like, hardcore strongman. Let me see here. Jeremy Strong plays his second eldest son. He's the one that's trying to really finagle to take control of the whole business. Who else is in here? Kieran Culkin, who's amazing. And exactly like when you cast Kieran Culkin to be in a role, he's sort of like the screw up guy that still ends up failing upwards in a way. Perfectly cast here. Sarah Snook, who I really enjoy. She's been in a bunch of stuff lately. Great, strong cast. And Matthew McFadden as the guy. Matthew McFadden, I just have to say, it is really great seeing him. I love him so much. I saw him back in Spooks back in the day when Spooks was trying to be like the 24 successor on the UK side. But most recently, he's been in a ton of like historical dramas, most recently in Howard's End. It is really hilarious to see Matthew McFadden play like an in-law. He is dating Sarah Snook's character, and he is kind of an idiot, but also kind of more relatable than everybody else in the family. And there are points where he gets to have his own little antisocial tendencies come out too. And it's just delicious seeing like, you know, the lowest person in the rung who clearly sees a weaker fish and is just like, I'm gonna you know, fuck this guy's life up a little. That is so much fun. Like, there is so much going on in the show. I think it starts off pretty strong. It feels like the pilot is trying a little too hard with what they're trying to do, but it really matures over time. This is a show that is definitely worth like investing a bunch of time in, and it was created by Jesse Armstrong, who co-wrote Four Lions, also worked on Peep Show back in the day.
Peep Show.
Thick of it. So like, this is a guy who knows his like political satire, and this show just transforms into being like this wonderfully dark comedy about these severely fucked up people who could just never really be happy, even though they have everything in the world. It's tremendous. You know, it goes places you wouldn't expect. Highly recommend it.
Oh, man, dude. You just, I mean, I've been on the fence about, like, should I watch this? But now
you should watch this.
I'm definitely going to check it out. But just so much to catch up on. Sharp Objects, too. I'm not caught up with
Sharp
that.
Sharp Objects. Oh, yeah, we haven't talked about that. That's also very good. Yeah.
I think we mentioned it. You mentioned it a couple weeks ago.
You compared it to, like, Sippin' Whiskey.
Yeah. I watched the first episode of Sharp Objects, was really impressed by it. But yeah, I got to catch up, man. Got to catch up with all this stuff.
Got to catch up.
So that's Succession. It's on HBO. Yep. Go ahead.
Yeah, only 10 episodes. I think it's a pretty easy catch up. But you know, it helps when you have 2 days when you're literally not doing anything else.
Mm.
Yeah. So Devendra's recommendation is throw out your back.
Throw out my back. Yeah.
I'm actually kind of worried. Like, Devendra, you're about to have a kid.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I have to be honest. The number one thing I am most worried about if I ever have a kid is not, you know, are they going to grow up to be healthy and are they going to be successful in life and find happiness and fulfillment? It is how destroyed my back is going to be lifting that kid.
Once you're dealing with the kid, yeah.
It is a guarantee. There is no way to put a child into a car seat 400 times without one time destroying your back.
Mm.
Yeah. Looking forward to all this.
Lot about my dad.
Our parents had it hard.
Pretty rough. All right, well, that's Succession.
I just remember constantly my dad being like, my back's out. And I was like, oh, that sounds awful. I'm like, I'm already at the age where I was like, why is my back doing this? I think I sat funny for a little bit today. It's horrible.
Well, that's Succession. It's on HBO right now. Devendra, anything else you've been watching?
Just real quickly, I saw this movie called MFKZ. Real title, the international title, is Motherfuckers, which is a great title. This is it's a French and Japanese co-production. Mm. It's an animated film about kids living in the slums of a city. It's basically like New Los Angeles. And they discover they have superpowers, and it's about this shadowy organization trying to stop them, trying to take control of them and their superpowers and everything. This is a movie that really owes a lot to, I guess, like all sci-fi. Like, it owes a lot to Akira, which I also saw recently too on the big screen. Owes a lot to The Matrix and Ghost in the Shell and a bunch of things. It's a gorgeous looking film. Not super original, But I think it's definitely worth seeing on the big screen. It has a great score as well. And I also just love this idea of, like, you know, the combination of, like, French geek, you know, French geek folks and Japanese, you know, animation folks, like, kind of coming together to create this thing. There have been some great French animated films lately. I think April in the Extraordinary World from last year or 2 years ago was fantastic. So I just love
it. It's on Netflix now.
It's on Netflix. It is worth watching. It's a gorgeous movie. Yeah. But yeah, I love animation in general. And I thought, like, you know, I'm somebody who cut my teeth on anime since I was a kid. And I just really love seeing, like, the art form kind of evolve over time. And this, like, you know, this hybrid thing of just, like, French style and Japanese animation, it's really cool. So definitely worth watching. I think it's going to be in theaters, think September? I have to double check that. But it's getting released here in the U.S. as MFKZ.
And how did you watch it, Devendra?
I saw it. It premiered at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. They do this animation festival every year. I saw it premiere there. Also, good reason to, like, you know, check out what your local theaters are doing, because sometimes you find cool stuff like this.
Very cool. That's MFKZ, and apparently it is an awesome combination of French and Japanese styles. Before we get to our first review of the evening for Blindspotting, we want to thank all the people who donated to the Slash Filmcast this week. We got to thank Scott Hughes. You know, every now and then someone has a donation, like a recurring donation, and then it fails because they cancel their credit card or something like that. And it's so easy at that moment to just be like, you know, who cares about the Slash Filmcast? Scott Hughes, he got a new credit card, re-upped his donation to us regardless. So really appreciate that, Scott. Thanks also to Donald McCoy for his donation. Thanks to new subscribers at the rate of $2 per month, Ragerland, Dean Promwalful?
Nailed it.
Michael Passafume and Jonathan Mills for donating at $32 per month. If you want to subscribe and support what we do here on the Slash Filmcast, go to slashfilm.com, use the Slash Filmcast tab, use the PayPal links on the side of the page, or go to paypal.me/filmcast. That's paypal.me/filmcast. Thanks to everyone who donated. All the support really does mean a lot. Let's get to our review of Blindspotting.
Is this?
Oh,
hey, I would like to get out.
Look at this.
I'm better wearing the glove, though.
Yeah.
I ain't trying to go back to jail.
$200.
Please let me out. Not Colin's gun.
Very nice.
Oh, I just got an Uber pickup.
You got it. Is this an Uber?
Hell yeah.
Tell him to slow down. No, you can't catch me. I'm on too fast on the gas. Don't chase me.
Put him up like this. You got him.
I'm a tough guy.
Do me a favor.
I got 3 days left on this probation.
When you got that gun on you, just don't tell me about it. Plausible deniability.
Oh, do you mean this gun?
Get out.
Good night, Colin.
Yo, bro.
Stop! Stop! Don't you! Don't shoot!
That was from the trailer for Blindspotting, and this is a movie directed by Carlos Lopez Estrada and written by Rafael Casal and David Diggs. I'm going to read the plot summary from IMDb. While on probation, a black man begins to reevaluate his relationship with his volatile best friend. Blindspotting is a movie that is kind of sweeping the indie circuit right now, has gotten tons of really positive reviews, so I was really interested to check it out. And Christy Pushko, you were able to check it out this weekend, right? In preparation for the
Slash.
What'd you think of Blindspotting?
So I've been meaning to see it since, like, South By. Like, it premiered at Sundance and then it hit South By, but I got caught up seeing a bunch of other stuff there and didn't get around to it. And then I missed it when it first came out. So yeah, I was a little slow to catch up on this one, even though everyone I know was like, oh my God, it's so good. It's so good. But that was kind of all they were saying. It was like, it's so good. So it was that kind of, I knew roughly what it was about. I knew that it involved the premise we talked about. I knew it involved rapping, which of course it does because David Diggs is a rap star. For those that are not obsessed with Hamilton like I am, he is amazing and won a Tony for it, I believe. But anyway, I was fascinated and I was like, okay, let's go. And I saw it on Sunday and using MoviePass, so thanks MoviePass, and I was actually really blown away because it's just, it's, I don't know, it was just, I don't know what I was expecting, but it was more than I was expecting. And there's such humor in it, and there's such levity, but then there are these moments that feel very authentically devastating. And they employ a cliche that we'll talk about in spoilers to set up a sense of tension that grows throughout the film. And I thought it was a really smart play, and it speaks to the politics of what's going on right now in a way that you can't ignore it. And I think it's a really exciting film. I think the performances are amazing. The writing is astounding. And it's so hard hitting. It was phenomenal. I actually was toying with the idea of doing a double feature because I still haven't seen Mamma Mia 2, which I know
they
that
totally go together.
That's kind of my problem. Like the way the screenings worked out, I couldn't do Mamma Mia first. So I was like, I'll do Blindspotting and then I'll do Mamma Mia. And I got out of Blindspotting and I decided I couldn't see Mamma Mia because I wanted to sit with Blindspotting. Like it gave me so much to think about, and it gave me so much to like experience that I didn't want to just dive into something else. So instead of going to see Mamma Mia 2, I like went for a long walk and just thought about the movie, and that felt really special.
Very cool. Devinder Hardwar, your thoughts on Blindspotting?
Yeah, I talked about it briefly last week, actually, I think, or 2 weeks ago. But I just want to say, like, this movie is incredible. It feels like, I said at the time, like, it reminds me of Spike Lee at his best. Just the way it kind of balances the reality of people just living their lives and going through, you know, their normal lives and, you know, the happiness and the sadness that entails. And then on the other side, there are just moments of absolute emotion and pure like dread and fear. And there's a lot going on. Like it's balancing all of this on a knife edge. So I thought that was really fascinating about this film. It's a movie talking about gentrification. It's a movie talking about changing Oakland right now. So it feels just as fitting as something like Sorry to Bother You as well. Another Oakland movie. So really cool that we're getting to see, these interesting stories right now telling us something about a changing landscape like Oakland. Oakland
appears prominently in Black Panther this year.
Like it's a Black Panther starts there. And I think that's all very important. Like we're definitely seeing art coming out of, you know, these communities that I think is very fantastic. And it's showing people, you know, sides of things that they may not normally get to see. I would definitely relate this movie to something like Do the Right Thing. It feels a lot like the Do the Right Thing for today. Where so much of it is just people hanging out and being friends and doing, you know, just having fun together. And at the same time, there's like this underlying feeling of anxiety and this, you know, potential eruption of violence that could happen or could not. But at the end of the day, like what this movie is about is how people kind of exist in that space. The trailer for this movie kind of sets up the plot. So I will mention like one thing, like a police shooting plays a big role in this movie. And I was fascinated how it just didn't go. It wasn't handled in the way I thought it would be. This right. isn't a movie about like a quest for justice or anything, because that's you see terrible things happen in your life all the time and you just kind of eats away at you. You can't do anything about it. And it's a movie about that, basically, just like trying to do what you can to exist in this world, even though you don't have, you know, control to find justice everywhere.
Jeff Cannata, your thoughts on Blindspotting?
I think it's my favorite movie of the year so far. It absolutely blew me away. I was so impressed with how it could achieve so many disparate tones and turn on a dime from one to the next. There are moments of complete silly, almost cartoonish humor, you know, very exaggerated, silly humor that's really fun and plays great. And then the next moment, it is deadly serious, absolutely topical and profound. And the fact that a movie can sort of dance between those things with such dexterity, it is amazing and moving. And you're absolutely right, Devinder, I think, with the Do the Right Thing reference. It also feels to me like a Swingers or a Clerks for a new, more socially conscious generation, right? It is that spirit of, you know, like the two guys wrote it so they could be in it. And it in the way those movies are stylized, but also feel like they're a page out of a truth that I know very, very well. This movie feels like that too. Like it's stylized in really fun ways, and yet also feels super grounded in a truth of the moment. The performances are extraordinary. It gets away with things that it shouldn't be able to get away with. It's an incredible film that I found completely moving. And in the same way that sort of Swingers and Clerks and Do the Right Thing are these movies about people that you just want to hang out with, I love that this movie, these characters are so real and so human and have such heart. This movie has so much heart. And I raved about Sorry to Bother You. I think this movie, for me, is superior. I mean, they're very different movies, but I think this movie nails the landing in a way that Sorry to Bother You didn't for me. And it has that heart. It isn't sort of, you know, it isn't just about the thing. I mean, there's some heart in Sorry to Bother You as well. Maybe it's a bad comparison, but I love the fact that these are about people that I like being around, and they just, one of them just happens to be an ex-convict, right? They're human beings and feel like very well-rounded human beings. We get moments with them that don't really need to be in the movie, but they're just human, wonderful moments. And I mean, I just adore this movie. And, you know, so many people we've noted, so many people were talking to me about, you know, I saw Christopher Robin for you this weekend, and I was like, it's nice, but go see Blindspotting. That's the movie you should be seeing, because more people need to see this movie. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, I agree that it's definitely a movie worth seeing. It's really, there's nothing else like it out this year, you know, just in terms of its style and in terms of the tone and the messages it's trying to convey. It's stuffed full of ideas, and it has, as you guys mentioned, a really great cast. The shifting between the tones didn't work quite as well for me as it did for you guys. I think there is this kind of theatricality to the dialogue, right? And that kind of takes it out of the realm of the real for me, which is completely, I think, you know, I don't know if that's what the movie's trying to do, but I don't know that it quite worked as well for me as it did for you guys. But despite that minor nit, I think it's still certainly a movie that's worth watching, and has a lot of stuff that's ultimately what this movie captures for me is this idea of being not in control of how the world perceives you. And not being in control of like how you're perceived by even your friends, and how terrifying and disorienting and frustrating and maddening that can be. I feel like for me, that's like what I got out of it. People can, you know, welcome to get all sorts of different things out of it, but for me, that's what I got out of it, and I felt like it rang very true in that message. And it's difficult to find a movie that really can bring that out, can provoke that emotional response, but this movie did that for me. So I would highly recommend it as well. I agree with pretty much everything you guys have said about it. Anything else before we dive into spoilers for Blindspotting? I think, let's get to it then. Spoilers for Blindspotting starting right now.
Now you're looking for the secret.
You're gonna see this coming.
No.
But you won't find it because, of course,
you're not gonna see this coming.
You're not really looking.
I have been puzzling over how it works.
You don't really want to work it out.
Who's in the box?
I have been dying to tell you.
I want to tell you my secret.
You want to be fooled.
In the past, on Twitter, a few times this year, I've talked about some of my favorite movie moments of the year. And I think several people pointed out to me the climax of this movie was one of their favorite movie moments of the year. What did you guys
meeting
think?
Meeting the
rap? Yeah, the rap with the police officer. Yeah.
It should not work. If you told me on paper that the ultimate moment was that this guy was going to rap at someone,
yeah,
you know, like I would be like, that's not going to work. That's going to be dumb. That's going to feel goofy.
Right.
And yet it's extraordinary. It is an electric moment.
My body, like when I'm watching it, Jeff, my sensibility is like, this should not work. But
right?
It should not work. But it is such a – he is so committed to that performance. Mm-hmm. You know what
and
I mean?
The rap itself is so exquisite.
Yes. I mean, it brought me over to the other side. Like I was like – I don't, you know, part of me's like, I don't feel like they should be working. And then it's like, but it's so the it's so raw and like so intense that I'm like, okay, you got me.
I could see Dave's head, like everything going on, like total inconsistencies. I don't know.
Yep.
Well, what's also extraordinary is the way that David Diggs performs. Like, I'm mostly aware of him from Hamilton, and in Hamilton, he plays Thomas Jefferson, and there's a lot of bravado in that performance. And that's kind of what I associate with him. So in this movie, to watch him play a character who is really trying to keep his head down and is not trying to draw attention to himself, it was so interesting to see that switch up and to also see him use rap in a different way, because, again, it's a different function within this film. And, like, you see him rap throughout the film, but it begins with him just playing around with Miles. And then it evolves to, like, when they're taking in that house that clearly, like, a family lived there, and we don't know what happened to them. And he's using that as a moment to, like, meditate and ponder what's going on in his city, in his home. And like, it's really beautiful and elegant, but it's like, then it comes together. So the wrapping within the film has an arc. And I think that's why that finale works so much for me, because yes, on its face, it sounds absurd that, like, okay, so he comes face to face with evil cop Ethan Embry, who shot the guy, and he raps at him. Like, that sounds dumb.
Yeah. But the whole setup for the scene, too, is like, it is really trying to make you think a lot of things, right? Like, oh, the alarm's going off. What is right. The alarm mean in
I
this?
I thought the he cops took were off... going to get called.
Yeah, the cops were going to get called. Right. He was, I think he was just wearing a t-shirt by that point,
right?
He wasn't identified as, you know, one of the workers who should be there. Like, so many things to make you think, like, this shit's gonna go bad.
Right.
Like, whatever is gonna happen here. And
it seemed like so many red flags from, like, a million posts from, like, The Root were, like, you know, some neighbor was gonna call and being like, no, I know they have a moving gym, but there's a black guy. They're totally robbing that place. Like, yeah. I my mind started rushing to all these headlines I've seen. Yeah. Sorry, I interrupted you. Go on. Sorry.
No, I think you were totally right. I may have interrupted you, Christy, but the whole setup for the scene, I just have to say, is masterful. But let's talk more about this. There's one I wanted to mention as well.
Well,
the problem I also had to get over with Ethan Embry being the cop is I recently watched Sneaky Pete, and he's such a goofball in that show, and it's like he's supposed to be this, you know, menacing, scary kind of.
I bought it. I didn't recognize him at all. Like, in the beginning, it said Ethan Embry in the credits, and the whole time I was like, where does Ethan Embry come up? And then I forgot about it, and then in the end, when it did the credits again, I was like, oh my god! Like, I've seen him recently and stuff, but he's not goofy Ethan Embry. So again, he was completely transformed to me. It was unnerving.
Devendra, I think you brought up a really good point in the pre-spoilers about how this movie does not take the path that you think it will take. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because in the trailers for, like, before this movie played, and I've seen the trailer elsewhere, there is, you know, I saw a trailer for The Hate You Give. Have you guys seen the trailer for that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is like, that is what I thought this movie was going to be. You know, like, it is about person seeing their friend getting shot by a police officer, seemingly unjustifiably, and then, and like, this whole activist, you know, movement that occurs as a result of that. And I thought, oh, this is going to be like a very similar movie to The Hate U Give, but it's not that at all. It's not about how these horrors can incite action. It's about how, like, this horror for David Diggs' character is, like, suppressed and stuffed down because it's, like, what he needs to do to survive. In that way, it is more heart-wrenching than potential other permutations of the story. Christy,
what
were you going
to say? What I thought was fascinating is that there's kind of a Chekhov's gun thing going at play, right? And it's, like, on two fronts. Because the very first scene after, like that we start the story, because you see the scene before he's been convicted or whatever, and then it's, like, you know, 3 days before probation ends. And he's in the car, and it's the gun deal. So in that first scene there, it sets up Miles has a gun. Miles should not have a gun. That is clear right away. So you think of Chekhov's gun, the idea if you're going to introduce a gun in the first act, it better damn well go off in the second, right? So you're watching that gun. You're always waiting for that gun to come up. But then they kind of flip it where they also introduce the cop shooting. And that's, like, also a Chekhov's gun effect where you've seen a gun go off, and now it's kind of like you're waiting for the impact to hit. Like, we've seen the character who doesn't get a name go down, but we have to see how that impacts Davy Diggs' character. And so it's like throughout the movie, there's all these moments where, like, whenever Miles's child gets the gun, my heart was in my throat because I'm thinking, we set up the gun. This is what happens. And then that's not what happens. And then they go to the party and you're like, oh, God. And like, I thought the way they used the tension of these things was amazing. And then it's like, even after the party, when the gun goes off, Miles gets away with it, right? And it's again, Colin has the gun, and Colin is walking down the street when a cop car finds him. And it's like, this gun is just a harbinger of doom, right? And of like, it was just really astounding how the gun changes context scene to scene, but it's always held in this light of like, this brings on problems. This does not solve problems. And it's not in your face about it, but there's a very strong political message in that. And then on top of that, you have the messages about like white privilege effectively by comparing the two lives of Miles and Colin. Mm-hmm. And that was, I did not expect that. I was really taken aback by how elegantly that story is told and how the story confronts it and how the characters confront it after the party. The scene in the parking lot was just riveting.
That was actually the highlight of the film for me, not the final wrap. It was that scene when all this tension between the two of them, all the unspoken things just kind of boil over and spill out into the open. And the way they play it was so much frustrating. Like, there's just, it captures that feeling. Like, you want to communicate this feeling to this other person who's been in your life for a long time, but you're unable to. I do this in my own life. I call it the slash film cast, actually.
Tracks.
I really love like the really well acted and kind of just you, it really gives you empathy for each of those characters when you're in that moment.
I gotta say, my favorite part of the movie is the story of what happened and how wonderfully set up all of that is, and
the Ant-Man flashback.
Ant-Man style flashback moment. But it's so, I mean, I don't think it's a riff on that.
No, I'm being
clear. It's just a great flashback. Yeah,
it is. But what I love about it is, we have this big mystery of what is his crime, right? There's a question there through the whole movie. What is his crime? What is his crime? What is his crime? And he's avoiding it. He's talking about it's looming ever larger in his, you know, in the relationship that he has with his ex-girlfriend, all of that stuff. And then the way it's revealed is it's so out of nowhere in this moment. And it's done in such a fun way, you know, like, oh, this is awesome, which is completely undermining all of the doom and gloom that we have, you know, and it's been laden with throughout the entire film. I just thought that was such a brilliant flourish of, we're going to make this the most fun thing ever.
Well, it starts fun. It certainly doesn't end fun. Like, I love that flashback because, yeah, it starts off like, oh man, like, you were that dude and this crazy story and like regaling all of this, and like, you're really with it, right? You're really with the guy is Utkarsh Budkar, who he was in Mindy Project and a bunch of things. I love that whole sequence of people just like relaying this crazy night they had,
right?
But the, like, what starts off fun, like, is the quit, you know, the horror that, you know, kind of that starts to like dawn on you as you realize, like, okay, this guy is on fire. He's really bloody right now. This is not going to end well for poor Colin. And it's one of those things, right? It is just the look at a bad decision, a dumb decision. Even if you think you were right, you were in the right to like punch this dude for being a dick. At the end of the day, like, you will get punished for it. And certainly, like, They just mentioned, they throw away like how badly it was. Like, that guy was in he was in the hospital for a week. I think he was in a coma for a week or something. Like, it is much more brutal than I think we expected to. So I like the way that it's both, you know, introduced as a fun flashback, and then it's quickly like, oh no, this isn't fun. This is just like a very bad decision, and you paid the price for it. After that point though, like, seeing how much Colin basically took the jail sentence for Miles to help his friend out, I definitely saw Miles in another light too. It was like, man, you need a better friend. Like, this is, I understand you grew up with this kid, but man, he is ruining your life. And I think one of the fascinating things about this movie is how they don't really reconcile. Like, they have the fight, they have that great conversation in the warehouse, but it's, you know, the next day after the whole police standoff, it is them just joking around again. I hope that, you know, they both learn from something from this experience. But at the end of the day, like, Miles seems like somebody who has no impulse control. And those sorts of people are just like, yeah, if you're friends with them, they will fuck up your life.
Right.
Before we get too far away from that, moment though, that started this conversation, I just want to say that I think it's another example of how this movie seems to be able to get away with things that shouldn't work on paper. Like the idea of the guys who just happen to be there that day walk into the place of work when he happens to be with standing right. It's like, that shouldn't work. That shouldn't be a thing that plays. You know, I should go, that's a dumb way to reveal. But this movie gets away with it. And I think this movie, it's a credit to how well it's all constructed that it does work.
Mm-hmm.
Christy, what were you going to say in response to the Avengers point?
Well, I was what I think is interesting with Miles is, like, you know, we get to see how Miles, like, he calls him out in the parking lot. Miles doesn't have to deal with consequences because, frankly, his skin color protects him. And, like, now that the neighborhood's being gentrified, kind of even more so, because he can easily be mistaken for a hipster, which is what happens at the party, and which rankles him so intensely. And I get it. I do. But it's also like he just doesn't have to go that far. And it's like Miles just has, as you said, like there's no impulse control there, but there's no lesson for him to learn either, because he's clearly lost his temper before. He's clearly done dumb shit before, but he always gets a near miss. You know, he doesn't go to jail. His kid doesn't shoot himself. Like, you know, it doesn't seem the cops are going to catch him for beating the shit out of a guy at a party. There's no repercussions. So there's no incentive for Miles to do any better. And, like, poor Colin, like, he screwed up horribly once. And now it seems like his frustration is no matter what he does, it doesn't seem to matter anyway. Like, he's trying to get his life back on track with Val. And I think the first half of the movie, we're supposed to be frustrated with her. Like, why is she giving him such a hard time? Why, you know, why wouldn't she visit him in prison? And then what's, as Devendra hinted at the end of that flashback, you totally get why. And, like, the scene where they talk on the phone and he says, "When you look at me, will you always see the fight first?"
That's so cool.
It literally took my breath away. It's such a raw moment, and
to be able to see them both on screen and living in that moment instead of it being a shot reverse shot, it's literally a split screen.
It's a split screen. It's
so smartly done, I think.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, they pull off stuff like split screens have been passé for so long, and yet they work really well in this movie. And I thought it's like, it's so hard to talk about gentrification in a way of balance, and it's so hard to talk about privilege in a way of balance where it doesn't sound like you're either lecturing or accusing someone. And I think that this movie manages to talk about both those things with a real elegance, but also a real entertainment value and a real humor. So like that flashback, you're kind of lured in by the fun and by the flow of it. And the same thing with, like, you know, Miles's bullshit raps whenever the slang he spins to sell boats or old hair products or whatever. Like, you're lured in with the style, and then the substance hits you and it just carries you. Like, I was just really struck by how strong this movie is because, like I said, people kept telling me it was good, but no one was getting into the specifics. So it was a surprise. And it's really cool when you have my job and you can still be surprised by a movie, even after people have been talking about it for literally months.
Indeed. Devendra, I wanted to say one thing about what you said about, like, whether they changed by the end. I did get the impression that they had changed. You know, I got the impression that they'd both gone through this entire thing. You know, Shane Black once said this thing about how when you he was doing press for The Nice Guys, and he said when you're watching a movie that takes place over the course of, like, 1 week or two, you are watching the most important week of that character's life. Like, that is his kind of philosophy of making movies and writing movies, is, like, you're watching the most important week of their life, because otherwise, if it's not, like, why would you bother telling that story? You know, and that's kind of how I felt about this movie. Go ahead, Jeff.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there. No, you get a clear sense of it when he has that sit down with his wife at the table, and Miles is, you know, he's a very changed person in that moment. You know, he comes in beaten and bruised, and yet there's still an explosion of anger there. But then, you know, he asks her not to use the N-word around him. And I it does feel as if he has had a paradigm shift, you know?
Yeah. Mm. But, you know, in reality, we know that character change is never a straight line, or it usually isn't. And mm-hmm. I'm not saying, like, everything's great from now on, but I do think, like, they're on a better path now. That's my feeling about it, at least. So anyway, any other thoughts before we wrap this up?
I just wanted to mention the scene with the kid afterwards where he goes outside to play with Colin, and Colin chastises him and points a finger and says, "Stop it." And the kid throws his hands up and says, "Don't shoot, don't shoot."
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah, because there are pamphlets for that to teach your kids how to protect themselves.
Right. And
the
when
cops,
I saw the
like,
pamphlet,
oh
my assumption, it said the talk. I thought it was going to be a sex talk pamphlet. And then when they reveal what it was later, I mean, you know, that was a moment where my own white privilege kicked in, where, like, that's not a conversation my parents ever had to have with me, because I have a protection in that I am a white girl. And, like, that's something I was aware of before going to see this movie, because of a friend of mine who talked about that experience with her own children. But to see it in that context, to see a kid that little, and to see a kid that little being taught it as a game so that they understand the reaction they need to have, but also so that they're not scared. Like, I mean, the movie just has those moments that are so artful at expressing the trauma that we are inflicting as a society right now. And that was part of why I needed to just walk with it for a bit. And I'm astonished by this movie, and I'm really grateful for it. I think that they put together something extraordinary that speaks to where we are and speaks to where we need to go.
All right. Well, that is our review of Blindspotting. You should go see it. It's out in theaters right now. We're going to move on to another review of Christopher Robin. But before we do that, Devendra Hardwar, you have not seen Christopher Robin.
I have not.
Because you have no interest in seeing it.
And you really don't want Christopher Robin spoilers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it has to do with bears. Yeah.
So you're going to peace out, Devendra. Where can people find more of your work?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter at Devendra, and I write about tech at engadget.com. I have some cool stuff coming up, including a piece about MoviePass, which should be up by the time this podcast goes up. So check that out.
Very cool. And please, guys, send Devendra your well wishes at Devendra on Twitter. I assume you're still recovering, Devendra, from your back injury.
It's been kind of a struggle just sitting up for this podcast, but it's getting better. That's the thing. Just all right. Laying down.
Best wishes,
all you have to
bud.
Do.
Yeah, yeah, feel better soon, dude. Feel better.
Thank you.
And, yeah. We'll see you later.
Later. Bye, guys.
All right, let's get to our review of Christopher Robin.
Ooh, I do like a party.
Come on, babe.
What should happen if you forget about me?
Silly old bear.
I won't ever forget about you, Pooh. I promise. Not even when I'm 100.
We should be working this weekend, Robin.
But I promised my wife and daughter I'd take them away this weekend.
All hands on deck.
You won't be coming to the cottage.
Well, it can't be helped.
Your life is happening now, right in front of you.
What to do, what to do, what to do. What to do indeed.
Pooh?
Christopher Robin.
No. The tree I remember was in the countryside, not here in London. There's no opening.
I suppose it's where it needs to be.
Well, that's a silly explanation.
Why, thank you.
Pooh, why are you here?
Oh, yes, I need your help. I've lost all of my friends.
Let's get to the bottom of this. Look up, Pooh. Here I come. It would appear that I am stuck.
Have you just eaten honey?
I have not just eaten honey. I wonder which way.
I always get to where I'm going by walking away from where I have been.
Do you?
That's the way I do it.
Hello, Eeyore.
That was from the trailer for Christopher Robin, the newest film by director Mark Forster. I'm going to read the plot summary from IMDb. A working-class family man, Christopher Robin, encounters his childhood friend, Winnie the Pooh, who helps him to rediscover the joys of life. All right, so we're going to give our brief thoughts on the film and then dive into spoilers, because it's going to be hard to talk about this movie without spoiling at least some stuff. But Christy, you were really excited to talk about this on the podcast today. Why was
it? I was. Because I hate this movie.
Okay.
I hate it deeply. I love Winnie the Pooh. I grew up with the Disney animated cartoons more than the books. But I loved Pooh's kind of jaunty tales. I loved how he didn't seem too bothered by anything. I loved him getting stuck in walls. I loved his songs. I love the 2011 movie that didn't do very well, but is enchanting.
The hand-drawn animation, right? You're talking about, right?
It's beautiful. Yeah, it was really lovely. But this movie has concerned me for a time. And it was because when they announced it, one, focusing on Christopher Robin, which if you know anything about the real Christopher Robin, Milne, his life wasn't awesome. Two, they like announced, they're like, oh, Alex Ross Perry's going to write this. And I was like, oh, the guy known for like ennui navel-gazing dramas? Sweet. Then they hire Mark Forster, who like, I was like, so it's going to be like they're finding Neverland. That's what we're going for. And like all of this made me steadily more concerned. They hire Tom McCarthy to clean up the script. They hire, I think, what is her name? Allison. I want to say Shoemaker. Did I remember that? Schroeder. Allison Schroeder from Hidden Figures. And to me, both of those hires on the script seem to suggest that they're trying to kind of like get a little more heart in there, because those people are known more for like things that are kind of depressing but also inspiring. And I was just like, oh, I'm not gonna like this, am I? And then it's like when the designs came out, just what are these designs? Why does, like, I understand the drive to want it to be photoreal. And you're thinking, oh, but if they're toys and of the era and blah, 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 they should be, like, raggedy and stuff like that. But to me, Pooh and his friends in this movie look like they can wander off into, like, It or an Annabelle sequel. Like, they're creepy looking.
And I actually think most of the creatures look fine, but Pooh himself looks really, really worn. You know, like, really worn out.
I think his mouth is just too small.
I think the mouth is part of it.
He looks in rough shape.
If you look at the posters, they are all very vividly colored, yes. Like they're in a cartoon. If in the movie, they are not. Everything has, like, a gray pall over it for, like, the first hour. And, like,
it's
watching
very washed
it,
out,
I was...
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just bummed. I was just like it's as if they can't, like, it's as if they hired a bunch of Eeyores to make this movie. And like, look, I love Eeyore, but you need the balance. You need some Tigger. You need some energy. And this movie is just such, like, it's so dour for the first hour that, like, it hits one point, which I guess we can talk about in spoiler. No, I'll just say it. There's a point where Christopher Robin screams at Pooh for a while, and I was like, I wanted to leave. If I did not have to, like, sit there and watch that movie for my job, I would have walked out, because, like, there is enough terrible stuff going on right now in the world. I do not need a full-grown man yelling at Pooh Bear. Like, how dare you, sir? So, yeah, no, I hate this movie.
All right. Jeff Cannata.
Christopher Robin. Well, this is going to go well.
Jeff loves it.
No, I didn't love it. I thought it was delightful. I didn't love it. I think the third act is clunky and abrupt and poorly executed. I think we'll talk about that in spoilers. I think the third act is straight up bad. But I liked most of this movie. I had a lovely time. I don't have a particular affection for Winnie the Pooh as a character. I mean, I was a child at one point, so of course I am familiar with Winnie the Pooh, and the voice, the fact that they got, you know, that voice to do Pooh again is iconic and stirs something in me that is deep and childlike. But mostly what I loved about this is that sense of Pooh as, you know, as written as a, you know, a Zen cone, you know, like his sort of Zen philosophy of life. I found it to be enchanting. I really did. I thought, you know, I'm sort of living this life of Christopher Robin, where, you know, I have a young child and I'm podcasting in the evening where my child has to go to bed. And, I don't know. I related to some of it. I didn't find it to be particularly, morose or off-puttingly, melancholy. I just thought it, I thought the third act was bad, but I thought the characters were all delightful. I thought the design of what is it? 100 Acre Wood. It was evocative and interesting and fun. And it felt like a little diorama world, come to life. I don't know. I enjoyed this movie.
So Jeff, in this analogy, if you're Christopher Robin, I am Mark Gatiss in the movie. I'm the one forcing you to do things away from your children, right?
Indeed you are. And you,
but at least you're actually working too, and you're not like golfing.
I was just going to make that point. You're golfing as I toil away.
I think this movie was really...
You often take credit for my work.
I think this movie is really weird, guys.
Yeah.
I think it really is very weird. And I think the first 15 minutes is so relentlessly depressing that it's unclear to me if the movie can ever fully recover from it.
Again, this is like first 15 minutes, so I feel like we can just say this. They basically murder A.A. Milne in the opening, which is really a bold choice. But someone pointed out to me that he is not playing Christopher Robin Milne, even though the movie is called Christopher Robin. He has poo, and like he has like some incidences that also occurred in his life. Not the death of A.A. Milne. That didn't happen until Christopher was in his 30s. But like, you know, going to boarding school, and he had a wife and he had one daughter and he served in the military and all this kind of stuff. Robin is supposed to be his last name, is what someone pointed out to me. So it's Christopher Robin. And I was like, that's so weird to me that you would make a movie about Christopher Robin and Pooh where like the Pooh books don't exist. And I don't understand so many of the decisions that went into making this movie.
So I think opening is pretty brutal. But here's the thing. Ultimately, this message, it feels very extremely similar to like the Toy Story movies to me, right? Toy Story 3 specifically, I think, which is basically about like this child growing up and about moving past the time period when you're playing with toys, but then discovering that, hey, there's something really valuable about the art of play, about whimsicality, about having fun in your life. You know, Jeff, when was the last time you had some fun in your life?
Right. Not since I started working for you.
Yeah, I know. Seriously, it's all been downhill since then.
Yeah.
And
I did not know what I was opening up when I suggested we review this.
You know, so I think...
I don't think it's fun necessarily. It's more like purposelessness.
play. Well, that's what I mean when I say play. You know, it's this idea of play as an end in and of itself. Like the idea of letting your mind wander, of exploring things.
Nothing can lead to something.
Yeah, but that, I mean, I think it's less even play than it is. It's this Zen idea of like, don't do.
Mm.
Don't do. Just be. Mm. And that's what I liked about the movie. It is an odd message, but it's... I found it to be lovely. I really liked that zen-ness of it.
Well, I also
Pooh stuff, and I like Pooh stuff. That when you actually get to spend time with the characters, I enjoy that more. Even though I just couldn't settle into the look of them, but as you pointed out, like Jim Cummings' voice is great. He's done Tigger and Pooh for I think all of my life. And so to hear his voice in those characters is wonderful. And the other characters that they bring in, like they bring in like Brad Garrett and Peter Capaldi and plug in some people to fill out the other voices. They're not so much imitations, but they are true to the spirit of those characters. And all of that stuff I liked. What I have issue with is I don't understand why when you have this collection of wonderful characters and you have all these lovely stories you could tell, you choose a news story centered on like a midlife crisis having workaholic who has a wife he barely pays attention to and a daughter that he refers to as if she's a business associate. Like, I just don't get why that's the story you're trying to sell to families. There is literally a paperwork montage in this movie.
Well, again, in the movie's defense, I think, which is not a movie I really want to defend, I think this idea of... like rediscovering this part of yourself that you'd forgotten long ago that was less concerned with the challenges and everyday drudgery of the world, that part really resonated with me. I got to say it did get a little bit dusty, these moments that Christopher Robin spends with Pooh. I did get a little bit verklempt, as they say. So I would say I'm probably in the middle, in between you two in terms of your opinions on the movie. But there's a little bit more to discuss. Why don't we do that? Go ahead, Jeff.
One thing I just want to say, just in case it's unclear to anybody, I promise I do not have a dog in this fight that has anything to do with the Sunday Movie Wager. I didn't go into this movie wanting to like it because of that. I'm being very honest with how I feel about it. I did not love it. I did think it was was a pretty positive experience, but it is a majorly flawed film and not one that I'm advocating for simply because of the movie Wager. So I just want to put that out there.
That didn't even occur to me, Jeff, but
it's weirdly, this movie has become associated with me among our audience, you know, so that's
fair enough.
Have become its champion, whether you wanted to or
indeed,
not.
Yeah. Indeed.
All right, let's get to spoilers for Christopher Robin starting right now.
Now you're looking for the secret.
You're going to see this coming?
No.
But you won't find it because, of course...
You're not going to see this coming.
You're not really looking.
I have been puzzling over how it works.
You don't really want to work it out.
Who's in the box?
I have been dying to tell you.
I want to tell you my secret.
You want to be fooled.
So I feel like this movie turns into a horror film in the last, third. Because the entire movie, right?
Go ahead, sorry.
The entire movie, you never see anyone interact with the stuffed animals, right? Because and when Christopher Robin is like, hey, shh, don't talk to the other people, my assumption was that Pooh is in his head, right?
Like, that's what I love about this movie, because every other movie like this, he would be the only one that could see them.
Right.
Or his daughter would be able to magically see them too, because she's still childlike. But I love the fact that this movie straight up says these are fucking alive.
Yeah.
They are alive and they're creatures that we have never known in the world before. You have to fucking reconcile that.
Well, it's like what I find odd is like that's kind of just played for laughs and not, I don't know. That's so strange to me that he's basically like, just stay still because I don't want to deal with it. Like, I don't know.
They encounter has this like moment of like existential crisis because they just saw a living being that has never existed before.
The metaphysical implications. This movie opens a Pandora's box of metaphysical. Like, so does that mean like all stuffed animals are alive? Do you know what I mean? Like,
I don't think so.
Also, can all like all animals talk? Because rabbit and owl talk,
right? So
I think that what this movie is claiming is that there is a portal through which you can enter another world where stuffed creatures exist and interact with talking real creatures, and that those have gained access to our world at various times in through history, and one of these times, they interacted with more than just one young boy. They interacted with a whole cavalcade of characters and caused chaos in Sussex.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so but to get to Dave's point about it being like a horror movie, the part where they go find the girl in the tennis court, like that is, I mean, like I'm waiting for someone, as soon as this hits DVD, I'm waiting for a bunch of those like horror trailers to come out, because it's just like, she's like, who's that? And then the ball rolls out to her menacingly. It's so weird. And like, that's like, the design of this is so confounding to me, but like, I actually, and the third act has a lot of problems, and I do not understand how you should give everyone paid vacations makes any sense as a solution to their budget problem.
Correct. Yeah.
But I at least liked that there's like a rollicking adventure to be had in the third act. Like, finally we're getting some energy. Finally we're getting to do something other than watch Christopher Robin berate and yell at Pooh more times. Like, that was just such a bummer. And then like, even like, oh, just like when he's like, just quietly, and then Pooh's just looking out a window going, house. I was like, this design is creeping me out.
Like, I laughed. That was funny though. That's a funny scene where he's like, you do it quieter.
Funny. Yeah, the beats are funny, but it's just like the look of the characters. They're not cute to me. They are creepy. Like, it looks like a forgotten Puppet Master scene or something. Like, and they put so much effort in. And the other thing that drives me crazy is that, like, we've had Paddington. And the thing is that if you remember when they first released, which maybe you guys don't because I know you two hate trailers, but when they released the very first Paddington trailer, the internet freaked out because they were like, nope, Uncanny Valley, you guys have gone creepy. This Paddington is upsetting. And people did all these memes of, like, Paddington being cut into The Shining and all these different kinds of things. And it made sense because that Paddington looked upsetting. And then they like retooled, came back a couple of months later with a different trailer. They had tweaked enough of the CGI so that Paddington looked adorable and not upsetting. And like, I don't understand how Disney presumably saw that and then went with this design. And I understand some people like this design. I find this design unnerving and it upsets me. I just want a cute, cuddly Pooh. And like, this bear it looks like something that would be possessed in an episode of Paranormal Witness.
I get what you're saying, but I also think you're overstating it. I get that you feel very strongly about it, but I didn't get that impression. And I think there are plenty of people who can find these characters to be not menacing and creeping.
I mean, say what you will, Christy, whatever they were trying to do, they really went for it. You know what I mean?
They did. They made some bold choices. Yeah, and I appreciate a bold choice. Big swing.
Yeah.
I'll give them that.
They swung big, and maybe for you they missed big, but at least they really tried for something as opposed to it being, you know.
I really think the only one you can even say that about is Pooh. And I think it's because he has those tiny beady eyes and that tiny mouth. But I don't think, you know, Piglet looks menacing or even Eeyore or Tigger. I think they're all sweet, cuddly little things.
We should say, by the way, that Eeyore, in my opinion, was great in this movie.
Yeah.
He kind of steals the show almost in terms of how hilarious he is.
He always did in those cartoons. Yeah, he was exactly. always, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's the sarcastic. Well, not even sarcastic, but he's the Debbie Downer, but it works.
He's got legit mental.
As we're talking about this, I have the IMDb page up, so it just keeps showing me every character design. I'm like, no, I get it. I get it.
So I guess we haven't spoken enough yet about the implications, Jeff, you're saying there's this other world, right?
Where, yes.
Okay. So, but can only Christopher Robin and his family go to the world? Or?
My understanding is that Christopher Robin happened to live in a place where the portal appeared for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And so he just, as a young boy, stumbled upon it. And this universe has existed beyond the other side of this portal, you know, in time memoriam. But he... as just blind luck that happened to be living in Sussex at the place where the portal first appeared. We now know from the movie, it is now canon that this portal can appear in multiple places.
I know, that's terrifying. That's terrifying. Did you guys see The Shining? Stanley Kubrick's masterpiece, yes. Right? There is this moment in The Shining when Jack Nicholson is talking with the ghosts, right, behind the fridge door. And they're expressing their like dissatisfaction with how things are going. And you hear this click of the door opening, right? And like they've unlocked the refrigerator that Jack Nicholson is in. And that is when you realize for the first time that these spirits, whatever they are, have power over the real world, right? It's a terrifying feeling. That's exactly the emotion I had watching Pooh interact with non-Christopher Robin characters in this film, right? It's like the reality between the line between reality and fantasy has been breached. You know, the center cannot hold. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Anyway,
there's that great moment with great cameos with the dude from The British Office and the guy from all those other great British shows that I have mentioned before, that whose names I can't remember right now, as the cop and the people on the street and the cab driver and the cop is trying to, the cab driver's like, no, something horrible happened. And then they all see it, you know, they all see who and the other characters. And for those characters, their life is going to be a living hell from now on.
Yes.
Because they have three people, they have three friends that they are now linked with in time forever.
It's like you're basically setting up a Stephen King movie.
Yes.
No one will ever believe them except the three of them.
Yes.
And they will all constantly call each other at 2 o'clock in the morning and go, I'm not crazy, right? We all saw it. We all saw it. And they'll be like, yeah, man, yeah, I can't sleep either. We saw it.
Exactly. Because it's very upsetting, this movie. How do you turn Pooh into a horror movie? And like, yes, I love Pooh and yes, I love horror movies. There are certain things that just do not go great together. I also love tilapia and chocolate. These are not things I need to have together.
Fair enough.
I would like to point out the moment that I knew that Christopher Robin was a terrible, irredeemable father. and that moment was when he knows that all his daughter wants is for him to hang out with her. He can't because he's got so much to do, so little time. And then Pooh is like, come through the portal with me. And he's like, oh, fuck it. I'll go through the portal with you. Rather than spending a second with his daughter, he goes, yeah, I'll go through the portal. What's the worst that could happen? Knowing full well there's no time difference through the portal. He's mm-hmm. going to literally have some issues with time, and he's still fine with it. He's going to go through the portal and just, you know, reminisce with old Pooh Bear rather than do the right thing, which is go and hang out with his daughter, which he could easily have done.
He is a comically terrible father, right? I mean, like, it is hilarious how bad he is.
Well, also, that's such a bummer if you watch last year's Goodbye, Christopher Robin, which was about his actual life and about how his parents actually really sucked. And, like, it's just, oh, it's such, it's not, this. These are not the things I want in my head. I just want my sweet little Pooh Bear, like, singing about rain clouds and being a, you know, balloon-carrying little dope. Like, I do want him to just be.
Yeah. But it's again, I think we're basically done talking about this movie, but it's just like the moment when other people see Pooh interacting with the real world, right, Jeff? Like, you've described it as like a horror film. They're all linked. I agree. It also forces me to like recontextualize the entire rest of the film until that point, you know, like, so Pooh has teleportation powers as well, right? Cause he can like. He can open that portal, like, wherever he wants. It's just like, what?
Well, to say he has power seems to suggest he has control over it, which I don't think he does. Like, if we're going to go that deep into the text of the movie, I think it's just that, like, I don't pretend to understand it. Something about honey and childhood, I don't know.
What I would like to step through, just for clarity's sake, for the sake of our audience, we should step through the moments, the, what, 30 years between the last time Christopher Robin leaves and the next time we see Pooh Bear. There evidently has been a horrible series of events in the Hundred Acre Wood. There has been some sort of perceived threat what are they called?
Heffalumps and Woozles. But that existed before. That's covered like in the opening.
No. But this time, because Christopher Robin's not there, it literally caused the destruction of all their homes. And
no, just Owl's toppled, right? Am I getting that wrong? I think they were all at a tea party in Owl's house, and the house fell over. He made it sound like it happened before.
Look, Christy, you're really minimizing how horrific.
The trauma. No, yeah, that's fair.
I mean,
I do have a question. A sincere question.
Hold on. Christy, hold on. Let's finish making this point, which is that. This is a horrifying sequence of it. Jeff, regardless of what has happened in the Hundred Acre Wood, let's not ignore the fact that Christopher Robin abandoned his animals, his stuffed animals, for 30 years.
Yeah.
30 years. Like, just
in the woods.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
and we never ever see Owl or Rabbit again, right?
You mean after the Heffalump situation?
Yeah. Yeah. What has become of them?
I think we see them again right at the end.
Do we see them at the end?
Yeah.
Don't know.
All right. Anyway, Christy, what were you going
to say? Well, I wanted to ask you guys, especially Jeff, like, do you think this is a movie that children will enjoy? Because I was surprised at the screening I went to. Often with Disney movies, you see a lot of kids there. And I think I saw one.
I'm so glad you brought this up. Oh, my God. I almost forgot to mention an anecdote.
Go ahead.
But I will first answer your question, and then I will say my anecdote. I do not think this is a movie for kids in particular, although I got numerous tweets all week long of people saying, I brought my whole family. My kids loved it. I'm so happy. Thank you so much. We were supporting you, you know, which was lovely. I don't understand that particularly. I do think this is a movie about a middle-aged, midlife crisis. And so in that sense, I related to it. That brings me to my anecdote, which is, as many of our listeners know, I have two children under 2 years old right now, and it is living hell. And I watched I went to a late show because that's the only time I can go to the movies now after my children have gone to sleep and my wife is mercifully trying to get some sleep before they wake up screaming. I went to like a 9 p.m. showing there's an AMC right across the street from my house. I don't know if you guys know that.
Never heard you mention that before. Yeah.
And so I walked over.
I feel like we've touched on that.
Yeah. And I'm sitting there, and I want you to understand I'm not exaggerating this when I say to you, a husband and wife walked in with what I can only describe as a newborn, a newborn child. I have very, very recent experience with this because my daughter just turned 3 months old. This child was younger than my daughter. Okay. And my jaw fell open because I thought, Who does this? There's no universe in which that child is going to survive through this movie. There's no – the audacity of these people to bring a newborn child into this theater. Why are we not all as one voice standing up and saying, no, get out
boo.
Of here.
Boo to you, family.
How dare you bring a newborn into a movie? A movie. A two-hour movie. A newborn? My child can't last 5 minutes without screaming her head off. I couldn't believe what I was witnessing, and they sat directly in the row in front of me. And so through the entire beginning of the movie, I was like the first 2 minutes, I'm like, here we go. That kid's, as soon as this music comes on, that kid's going to start screaming. And what are they going to do? Are they going to walk out with, are they going to stand and do the right thing and leave? I'm not kidding to you guys. This was a newborn child. And it, the woman like rocked back and forth with it and held it and nuzzled it. It didn't make a peep. About an hour into the movie, it started going, and so she stood up and left, came back in 2 minutes later. It survived the whole rest of the movie. And I was like, I hate you people so much for the incredible lottery win that you got upon the birth of your child. Because that shouldn't be possible. And the fact that you know that you can do that is offensive to me on every level. And the fact that you got away with it, I couldn't believe it.
They took that opportunity to go to a movie and pick Christopher Robin.
Well, Christy, they clearly can do this anytime they want.
Exactly. Why pick that movie?
They can do.
It's like movie pass. You're like, why not? We can go anywhere.
Movie-going child. This is a movie-going child is what they got. They got a movie-going child.
All right. So
I hate them. I hate these people.
I agree with Jeff in that I don't think young children would particularly like this movie. I think they'd get really restless and bored. I base that on my experience with my nieces, where I feel like this is way too many just adults talking about business and downsizing, and why would they care about that? And I just want to throw out also Hayley Atwell's in this movie, which I was really excited by, but she gets very little to do as the neglected wife who gets to look stern and smile with beautiful lipstick on. So if you're a Hayley Atwell fan, I don't think you need to be a completist and watch Christopher Robin.
All right.
She's surprisingly well adjusted to the idea of living creatures from beyond the portal.
I mean, I feel like her day only got better at that point, because she was like on the brink of like leaving her husband, because he's like, look, I love you, blah, 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 blah. But did I tell you about how important managing efficiency is in luggage?
Yeah. Right. And the pure economic logic of pay your people to go on vacation so they'll buy your luggage.
It's basically Christopher Robin invents the middle class is how that movie ends. Like, I don't really understand how that worked, but
cool. Yeah, that was pretty terrible. Okay. Well, I think those are our thoughts on Christopher Robin. This conversation really took some crazy turns, guys. Very much like the film itself.
Yeah.
All right. That's all for today's episode of Slash Filmcast. Find more episodes of this podcast at slashfilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Our theme song comes from adamwarrock.com. Our spoiler bumper comes from filmmaker Kyle Hillinger. Stay tuned to hear what we'll be discussing next week. In the meantime, Christy, where can people find more of your work on the internet?
I write all over the interwebs, but I write every day at pajiba.com, and you can find career highlights at decadentcriminals.com, and you can find me on Twitter at Christy Puchko, that's KristyPuchko. And as I said, I'm going to go on vacation soon, which I'm very excited about. So if you have beach read suggestions, podcast suggestions, or audiobook suggestions, please send them out to me at Christy Puchko, because I'm in that zone.
How about you, Jeff Cannata?
I'm in a different zone. Oh, that's not the question you're asking. I'm at Jeff Cannata on Twitter, spelled with two N's and two N's and one T. And
you've forgotten how to spell your name, Jeff.
Yeah, that happens when you have two kids. I do another show. It's all about video games. It's called DLC. You can find it at 5x5.tv/DLC. I hope you check it out. I appreciate it.
Find all my stuff at davechen.net, on Twitter at davechensky, that's davechensky. Next week, we'll be discussing The Meg. The Meg. Guys, if there's one thing I want you to take away from this week's episode of the podcast, go see The Meg. Because
Dave doesn't want me to win.
It's not so much you specifically. It's more like I want to beat everyone else.
I'm very excited for this week to get lots of tweets of pictures of movie stubs that are not the Meg.
That are not the Meg.
People with a little arrow that
please,
says not Meg.
Not I would love Meg. That.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you guys later. We watch the movies, flicks, tracks for the good, slide bad. It's the Slash Film Cast. For all the news and the movies coming out, because you know that it's the thing worth talking about.
This is Acast Recommends. Every week we pick one of our favorite shows, and this is one we think you're going to love.
Who exploded Vivian Stone? Was it Screen Hunk McSalad?
Mother's Digest called me dependably erotic.
Leading lady Joanna Shoebags.
Oh, you call me dramatic again, I will die!
First time director Wallace Byrne Matravers.
I think I'll just keep my clothes on for now.
Assistant director Laura Sidesalad.
If I can help you direct this film, I can certainly help direct your Winkler.
Technician James Wigington.
You've got a funny way of addressing a man holding a power drill.
Or someone else entirely. Listen in to find out who exploded Vivian Stone.
Acast is home to the biggest podcasts from the UK and around the world. Subscribe to this show and hundreds more now via Acast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.